From Odyssey, I'm Lauren Berry, and this is the On Deadline podcast, where you get a closer look at stories from our radio newsrooms across the nation. Today, On Deadline is again looking at the problem of senseless mass shootings in the United States, and we're asking what we can and should do to stop them. I'm sure that most of us can agree that thoughts and prayers aren't going to cut it anymore. Last Wednesday, before most schools in the country had even been open for a full week for this school year, a young gunman entered Appalachie High School in Georgia and opened fire, claiming the lives of four people and leaving nine others hospitalized. Among those killed were teachers Richard Aspinwall and Christina Iremi. Two 14-year-old students, Mason Schemmerhorn and Christian Engelo, were also murdered. The suspected gunman, 14-year-old Colt Gray, was taken into custody at the scene and is being charged with murder. He's going to be tried as an adult. Since the shooting, America has gone through its performative rituals of outrage, mourning, calls for change, political discourse, and calling for new examinations of how to stop gun violence and what should be safe spaces. At this point, we're all well-versed in the steps of reaction. Ever since the mass school shooting at Columbine High School in 1999, these scenes have grown only more common here in the U.S. We live in a world where active shooter drills are as standard in school hallways as fire and tornado drills. Why do these school shootings keep happening? Is this a gun problem or a culture problem or something even more deep-rooted? Dr. Jillian Peterson and her staff at the Violence Project have been studying mass shootings for the past 5 years. She offered some insight.
What are some of the solutions to keeping these types of tragedies from happening?
Yes. Good morning. Thanks for having me. We have been studying this for about 5 years. So we've tracked every mass shooting that occurred in this country going back to 1966. We've interviewed perpetrators of these mass shootings, people who knew them. We've gathered data on them to really try to look for patterns in who these people are and what their trajectory is to violence to figure out how we could intervene earlier. And what we know is that, in particular, for school mass shooters, there's this really consistent pattern where it tends to be young men who are isolated, who are students of that school, typically who have a history of trauma, who are suicidal, who are in crisis. Many of them tell people, the vast majority of them tell other people what their plans are. There's lots of warning signs that we tend to miss. And then, of course, they have access to the weapons that they need to carry out their attack. So our recommendations are things like anonymous reporting systems in schools where kids can report if they're worried about a classmate, crisis intervention training, crisis intervention teams in schools, suicide prevention training, and really this recognition that we can't secure our way out of this because these perpetrators are students of the schools themselves.
In this case, from what I understand, the FBI had been investigating him.
That is what seems to be coming out. And that's remarkably consistent, is that these are young men who are on the radar. People are worried about them. People are reporting them. In this case, all the way up to the FBI investigating this. The problem is, until something happens, law enforcement's hands are really kind of tied. You can't arrest somebody for sort of thinking or saying something. And so what we need is, once this person's on the radar, how do we intervene with this kid? How do we make sure that they're getting whatever sort of intervention that they need? And whether that falls to the schools, which is where it typically falls, then we need to resource them to do that.
So you're really going to the core, the people involved. A lot of times people will immediately say it's gun laws, it's access to guns, it's buying guns. Is there an element to that with what you're talking about, with what you study at the Violence Project?
So for school mass shootings, because the perpetrators are students of the school, they're not old enough to buy guns. So gun laws, while important for other mass shootings, they're less meaningful in these cases. These kids tend to take their guns from parents and people they know. And so what's really critical is actually safe storage of firearms. So in particular, for young men who are on the radar, who are telling people they're in crisis, who are actively suicidal or thinking about violence, it's really critical for those parents to make sure their guns are really secure. And the early information that's coming out is that that was not what happened in this case.
Since the shooting in Appalachia, several pieces of information have come out about the shooter and what could have been done to stop him. The FBI shared that in May of 2023, its National Threat Operations Center received an anonymous tip about online threats to commit a school shooting at an unidentified location. They were made by then 13-year-old Colt Gray. That tip led to an investigation by the Jackson County Sheriff's Office, which then interviewed Gray and his father. The father assured officers that while he had hunting guns in the house, his son didn't have access to them. At the time, law enforcement decided there was no probable cause for an arrest or additional law enforcement action. Later, new information about the day of the shooting also emerged. The boy's mother reportedly called a school counselor about 30 minutes before he opened fire. She warned them about a, quote, extreme emergency that was unfolding. Her son allegedly sent her a text that said, "I'm sorry, Mom." She talked to the counselor for 10 minutes and asked them to find her son immediately. It's still unclear why they didn't. Now Gray's father, Colin Gray, has also been charged. News Nation national correspondent Elizabeth Pran joined Odyssey to share more in the days after the shooting.
Yeah, I mean, this story is, it's actually quite breathtaking. I mean, initially when we arrived on scene at the courthouse, you know, we were anticipating perhaps at the first appearance, not only would we only see the 14-year-old, but that it was going to be virtual. It's been really an onslaught of developments. In fact, I just walked away from a press conference with a district attorney because he said, look, these are initial charges. And especially when it comes to Colt, he has not been charged for the additional 9 victims. As you know, 8 students injured, 1 teacher. This is an additional to the 4 who have passed, who were shot to death on Wednesday. He also clarified some of the second-degree murder charges for the father because there were some questions around it. Why wouldn't it be 4? Well, it pertains to some nuances in the Georgia law, and I don't want to bore your viewers, but it pertains to the heinous crimes when it comes to a child under the age of 18. So he clarified some of those. I asked him specifically if Colin, the father, the 54-year-old father, will be seeing additional charges. That's yet to be seen, but when Colt does receive those additional charges, we sort of start at ground zero, right? We have the charges filed, we have the arraignment, the first appearance, and that will take place. There is not a date set on that. There is a grand jury indictment date set for October 7th, and then preliminary hearing set for December 4th for both of these men. That, of course, is subject to change. But let me back up and start now at 9:30 when we saw the father, not anticipating to see the father. They did not have that in the plan. He walked into the courtroom, and it was very stoic, because I want you to remember that there's optics here, right? There are victims' families who we saw arrive on scene as early as 7:30, dressed in black. They were flanked by security. They walked in. You could see them. They were hanging their heads low. It was actually horrendous to see. So they're in the front, and they watched both of the legal proceedings. So Colin walked in, and they had a conversation with the judge, very stoic, read him his rights, and then went through really a litany of charges, right? You have the 2 felony murder second-degree charges. You have the 4 felony involuntary manslaughter. You have the 8 counts of cruelty to children in the second degree. That's up to 180 years behind bars. Now, if you go back about an hour, that's when we saw Colt. He walked in. The only thing he said was confirming his name. He didn't enter a plea. He was read his rights. Both of them are going to be getting new counsel throughout the afternoon, but they were represented when they arrived into court, and he did not set bond. So both of them are going to be behind bars. The 14-year-old is in a juvenile detention center just about 3 miles away, and then Colin is at the jail, which is on the campus where we are located. But again, the optics that we're seeing here is that, you know, as a consumer of news, we're trying to figure out who this person is, right, who allegedly carried out this crime. And then we're trying to be respectful that the community is still in such a state of shock. We were on the scene just about 2 hours after the first shots were fired. I mean, when I tell you mothers were running to the high school campus in flip-flops, a mile away, just trying to get to their children. So we're trying to honor both of these storylines, but the story is certainly still developing every minute that we're on the ground.
And Elizabeth, I just wanted to ask you, what are prosecutors saying the father did for the son, providing the weapon? How did that work?
So this came down late last night, and what they're saying, the words were very, very careful. It's knowingly gave him access to a weapon. And this all dates back to the fact that the FBI was at the house in 2023. He was then 13 at the time. It was Jackson County, which is about 15, 20 miles from where we are located. The FBI said, listen, we can tell you that there's anonymous threats coming into school. There's photographs of guns. There's menacing terms. And it's all linked to an email to your then 13-year-old son. The son denied it, said he was hacked, had nothing to do with it. The father believed him. And he did say, we have audio where he said, you know, I'm going to get him away from the video games. I've been taking him outside more. We do enjoy hunting. And so they said to him, does he have access to these weapons? And he said he does not have unfettered access to what sounds like an arsenal of weapons. Now, News Nation can't independently confirm that an AR was purchased for him at Christmas, that we have reached out to multiple sheriff's deputies to try to get that confirmed. Because what we can confirm is, was that the only AR in the home? How many weapons were there? Was this the weapon that was used? Are these reports true? These are all things, these are all answers that we don't have right now. But I will say, working with the sheriff's deputies with Barrow County, they've been hugely forthcoming, and they've been very, very swift. But anything pertaining to the investigation, they will be tight-lipped on because it's ongoing. And just when we heard from the DA, Brad Smith, there's more charges to come, so it behooves them to keep all that information. And, of course, it's our job to ask the questions.
Questions include whether there are laws that could have stopped this shooting before it happened, and whether the FBI should have followed up about Gray's threats more than a year before the shooting. Tim Carey with the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Violence Solutions joined Odyssey to share more on what could have been done.
So we've had countless shootings, mass shootings, school shootings, and two of these cases where the parents are charged. So going forward, if parents are charged, maybe other parents will do a better job of locking up their guns and preventing access for their kids. Or maybe kids who might be thinking about a mass shooting won't do it because they're concerned about their parents. But that's a lot of maybes. Do we just take progress where we can get it at this point?
Oh, that's a tough question. It's very fact dependent, these sort of cases. We have research dating back from past few decades that show that the overwhelming majority of guns used in school shootings by youth are accessed in from their parents' homes, from the homes of friends, but what really distinguishes this case potentially, but especially the Crumbly case, is the egregious nature of it. That it shocks the senses, all of the meaningful opportunities for intervention that were missed and all of the harms that were actively enabled by the parents. And I think that really distinguishes what we're seeing here from perhaps shooting trends in the past.
Right, because we've got this reporting that this gun was a gift after the law enforcement actually came to interview the whole family about these online posts. There was a post on Discord talking about a shooting, and of course the kid said, I wouldn't have ever made those, that wasn't me. But if the cops search your house and they want to talk to you about all that and you still buy a rifle for your son, then, I mean, that's where the prosecutors are starting to draw all these links.
No, exactly. And that's, again, what we saw in the Crumbly case, where the parents actively gave the child the gun, ignored clear concerns from school staff that they'd seen disturbing messages and threats and about violence that then later culminated into a shooting later that day. And again, facts are still emerging in this Georgia case, but we are starting to see some parallels here.
Increasing accountability for these shootings, of course, is one step, but you've said much more needs to be done in terms of mitigating the risks of more gun violence in schools. What does that mean?
Exactly. The best cure is prevention. And there are a broad array of evidence-informed toolkits that can help prevent shootings like this from happening. Especially in this case, there are two laws that come to mind particularly. The first are safe storage laws, especially child access prevention laws that many states across the country already have, that essentially require adults, firearm owners, to store their guns in safe and secure manner, especially when they think that they could potentially be accessed by children and people who shouldn't have access. We've seen these laws have a profound impact, especially on reducing pediatric firearm injuries, reducing firearm suicides, especially for adolescents, as well as some promising data for shootings and homicides and gun deaths as a whole. But in this case, if it's true that the father gave the child the gun instead of the child accessing it through some impermissible means, there's also another law that could have potentially been helpful, which are known as extreme risk protection orders, otherwise called red flag laws, that 21 states and the District of Columbia have, that allow courts to temporarily disarm people if those individuals are found to pose a serious risk of harm to themselves or others with firearms. And this case seems like a textbook instance of where that law could have saved lives.
Americans have been struggling with mass school shootings for more than two decades, and there's been a lot of hand-wringing and beautiful sentiment about the importance of protecting the lives of America's youth, but seemingly little has changed from a policy perspective. Little, but not exactly nothing. The biggest recent change has been the inclusion of parents in the legal system when their children kill. That ground was broken in Michigan, where Jennifer and James Crumbly, the parents of Ethan Crumbly, who killed his classmates in Oxford, were sentenced to at least 10 years in prison for supplying their son with weapons. Gray's father now stands to pay a price for the same thing. With politicians seemingly frozen in place when it comes to instituting change, is the legal system going after parents really the answer? The Washington Post noted the Michigan case no longer looks novel. Instead, it may have signaled a fundamental change in the way the justice system deals with gun owners whose children get a hold of weapons and take lives. In Georgia, a conservative haven where 7 out of 10 voters supported Donald Trump in 2020, the prosecutor is making it clear his case against Gray isn't about being anti-gun. "I'm not trying to send a message," District Attorney Brad Smith said in Georgia. "I'm just trying to use the tools in my arsenal to prosecute people for the crimes they commit." But going after the parents creates an agreement between both sides of the gun debate, because gun owners can be just as outraged as non-gun owners over dangerously irresponsible parenting. This show is produced by Joe Beatty, Christy Strouser, and me. I'm Lauren Barry, and I want to say thanks for listening to On Deadline, Odyssey's serving of a top news story just for you. Subscribe on the Odyssey app or wherever you find your podcasts to stay informed.